This is an interview with Paul Roscoe. Today is January 22nd, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So, to begin the interview, I'd like to ask you how you got interested in anthropology.
Yeah, long story. My undergraduate degree was in physics, and I came out with my degree in physics, and one thing I'd figured was that I really didn't want to do physics for the rest of my life. Ironically, I didn't feel it was intellectually challenging enough. It was primarily because, you know, when you're doing it at the undergraduate level, you're simply kind of being taught to recognize problem situations, what formula to plug in, how to crank the handle. Didn't seem much of an intellectual challenge. Certainly there's much more challenging stuff going on when you're on the frontiers of physics, I'm sure. But I wasn't wildly keen on that. This was a period of time in Britain when, as over here, there was a lot of student social activism, demonstrations, and so on and so forth. Mm. And I got more and more interested in kind of humans as a subject of humans and their societies as a subject of study, and really wanted to do something more over in the kind of social sciences or journalism side of things. And in Britain, that's really difficult, you know, you as opposed to over here, where you kind of like you declare a major, but you take a whole range of other courses and you can switch majors. At that time in Britain, I think it's probably still the case now, you kind of like you go to university, it's only 3 years, not 4 years. You go to university and you've declared what subjects you're going to do ahead of time, and you just do courses in that. You don't do courses in anything else. So, you know, kind of, in my case, I was trained to do physics. I wasn't had any qualifications to do anything else. Mm. So it was very, very difficult to move across. So I trod water a little bit, kind of doing a master's in liberal studies and science. And then kind of just by pure accident, reading a couple of books by anthropologists, kind of realized, geez, this is really what I want to do. And that's when I kind of got even luckier in many ways, in that it just so happened, this was at Manchester University in Britain, that the University of Manchester Anthropology Department actually had a master's program specifically for people like me. I don't know whether there's any other institution in the entire United Kingdom that had that program, mm-hmm. but it just happened to be there where I'd done my undergraduate and master's of science degree. And so they took me in, and kind of you do what I did was the final year of the undergraduate curriculum in anthropology, and then a 1 year master's thesis after that. Mm-hmm. And you know, that confirmed me that that's what I wanted to do, and so that's how I originally got into anthropology.
Okay, so at that point you decided to pursue a PhD in anthropology.
Yeah, and that was not easy, because by that point I'd got two master's degrees in Britain, kind of at that time, much less the case now, but at that point you kind of got university, you got government funding, both paying your tuition and paying you a stipend, you know, kind of something that's almost unheard of these days, but in my view is how you should run universities. Mm. But by that point, I'd used up all of my, what would be called over in Britain, postgraduate funding. You know, kind of like, I'd had my 3 years of funding for the undergraduate in physics. Mm-hmm. I'd now used up my funding for graduate studies, and that was a bit of a problem. You know, mm-hmm. I finally found what I wanted to do, and kind of very little opportunity to do it.
I'm sorry, so what is your second master's degree in?
My first was this liberal studies and science. My second was a master's in social anthropology.
Okay,
at Manchester University. Mm. That was the special program they had. You got a master's for doing the final year of the undergraduate course and, you know, a 1 year master's thesis. Mm. But then I really did want to go on to do the PhD, and there would have been some opportunities at Manchester, perhaps, in that the Manchester University Department had various kind of ethnographic projects. There was the Namibia project, there was the Lebanon project, the Syrian project, the Libyan project. They're all kind of like, if you were accepted into them, they would have kind of provided funds to go and do field work and write up a thesis. But I'm not sure how good your history of the mid-1970s was. But at that point, kind of, Libya was kind of going belly up under Gaddafi. The Lebanon was kind of getting into real terrible straits. Syria was kind of becoming a very difficult place to work in. So around about the time I'm ready to apply, that was all kind of folding up. About the only project that Manchester had left at that point was the Namibian project. But I was fortunate enough to, in the Manchester University Anthropology Department, they happened to have this notice up on the board that sort of effectively said free money to study at the University of Rochester. And so I applied to the University of Rochester in upstate New York and was accepted, and very grateful for that, and finished up my PhD at the University of Rochester.
And this was in the, by the late 70s you had finished?
This was, I came out, I think officially, my PhD is grant, it was dated 1983, I'd kind of finished the thing in late 1982.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you applied for faculty positions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was a very bad time to be on the market. The early 1980s was a recession. President Reagan had come in, and we were going through a pretty tough recession, and there were very few jobs, either in the US or in the UK. At that point, I'd become a permanent resident in the US, and so was eligible to apply for jobs here. And for a couple of years, I was kind of, I did 1 year at Hobart and Williams Smith Colleges in upstate New York. I did another year on a Lansbury Fellowship at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. And then I was really, really fortunate. I got the job here at the University of Maine, and been grateful for that ever since.
And about when was that?
That was 1984 that I came to the University of Maine.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't on the job market too long.
2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about how your relationship with the Quaternary Institute began.
Mm-hmm. This was, I can't remember the dates exactly, Adam. It was sometime in the early 2000s. As you may know, kind of the anthropology department has a lot of cross appointments to the Climate Change Institute. I think Dave Sanger was one of the early members of the Quaternary Institute, and so I think he was the first one that got a cross appointment. You know, kind of half of his budget line was through climate change, half was through anthropology. Then kind of we got a few more archaeologists who were kind of hired half into the Quaternary Institute, half into anthropology. So anthropology kind of since before I arrived has had strong links to the Climate Change Institute. It's always been the archaeologists who've kind of had the cross appointments, you know, kind of the split budget lines. And the cultural anthropologists haven't really been involved with the Quaternary Institute as it was then, simply because, you know, we don't do quaternary stuff, really. You know, kind of the archaeologists do stuff that can be called quaternary and you can keep a straight face, but cultural anthropologists didn't. But I forget the exact way in which the dates meshed, but Dave Sanger, kind of, who's now sort of Professor Emeritus here, for a number of years he was kind of suggesting that, you know, I kind of might be interested in kind of joining the Climate Change Institute in some kind of capacity. Although I'm a cultural anthropologist, I have for quite a lot of years been interested in archaeology. Not the digging, you know, in the mud and all of that sort of thing, you know, I'll leave that to them, but in the more theoretical side, because New Guinea is a really terrific empirical laboratory for kind of trying to understand the mechanisms and processes that sort of structure and organize small-scale societies, and kind of it's also being a great kind of laboratory for ethnographic analogies about the early stages of political and cultural evolution. So there's kind of a, I've always been interested in New Guinea ethnography from that perspective, and archaeologists are kind of interested in it. So I've always sort of had perhaps a little bit more overlap with the archaeologists in the department than our other cultural anthropologists. And Dave kind of, for 2 or 3 years, was sort of suggesting I should perhaps kind of think of joining the Climate Change Institute. And then I think, yeah, there was the point at which Paul Majewski joined the Institute, and it began to get this growing focus in climate change. And at that point, you know, by that point, I too had become interested in climate change. I mean, climate change has kind of been on the horizon since, I think, on my horizon since the late 1980s, I think it is. You know, kind of people just worrying about kind of what's going to happen here. And so I kept my eye on that for quite a long time, and was beginning to get more interested in that. So I can't remember, Adam, exactly when I joined the Institute. It might have been 2003, something like that. But eventually it kind of came together that I applied for cooperating professor status over there, went across and gave a talk on essentially the special report on emission scenarios that kind of undergirds the last two sets of IPCC reports. And yeah, people seemed to like the talk, and so, you know, I was accepted in there. And I spent a lot of time just kind of like going to lectures, talking to folks over there, with the main my main aim being to try and get somewhat on top of the natural sciences of climate change, with a view to kind of like what can one do as a social scientist, you know, on the human dimensions of climate change. And that's actually been a hell of a struggle, because, you know, just kind of like trying to get a reasonably secure hold on all of the natural science implications of climate change, and also kind of the drivers of climate change, is, you know, kind of quite a lot of study in itself, you know, to begin to get to somewhere where you feel relatively confident that you understand the basic processes, you know, the prehistory of it, kind of, and then kind of beginning to try and get a hold on what the human drivers of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions are. You know, this all then has to come from that, you know, kind of like trying to get on top of that literature, which in the last, probably the last 5-8 years, has suddenly exploded, you know, kind of, and it's not just in anthropology. There's some climate change research going on in anthropology, but there's lots of really interesting kind of climate change, human dimensions of climate change research that's been going on in psychology, for example. The American Psychology Association, in, I think it was 2010, produced this spectacularly good report on the links between human psychology and climate change, a whole bunch of different dimensions. There's a whole bunch of sociologists who've kind of got really interested in, you know, what can sociology do to contribute to understanding the human dimensions of climate change, you know. And I've kind of, probably in about the last 3 years, I finally got to that position where I kind of thought, okay, I'm actually kind of qualified now to start writing about this. And indeed, I've just had a paper accepted for the American Anthropologist, which is like our flagship journal, which is kind of pretty gratifying. And now I'm working on some other stuff, you know, kind of, it's very anthropologically oriented, but there's things that anthropology, with its kind of universal perspective, you know, kind of taking into account all human societies as our database, and kind of attempting to integrate all realms of human society, there's some things that we're kind of uniquely qualified to do. And that's kind of where I am at the moment, is sort of, it's, you know, I finally managed to get the momentum, having kind of got on top of a really large literature, to feel, yeah, I can kind of like, I can now start writing about this stuff.
So tell me a little bit about your latest article.
The it's actually on that kind of special report on emission scenarios that came out in 2000. Let me know if I'm boring you to death, all right, with the details here. But the IPCC, you're familiar with the IPCC, I presume?
Yes.
Yep. Their report's kind of coming out, and the last two, the ones in 2000, 2007, I think it was 2000, they're kind of trying to predict how is climate change going to develop over the next 100 years, mm-hmm. if we're taking 2000 as our baseline. And you kind of got two sorts of models that you have to use to be able to do that. On the one hand, you've got your physical model of how the climate works. And, you know, our climate researchers in the Climate Change Institute, you know, they kind of contributed considerably to that. You know, people like Paul Majewski, Kurt Marsh, they do a lot of that modelling. And kind of these models are phenomenally complex and surprisingly good given all of the unknowns involved. But it's kind of like they're looking at kind of like over the last million years, kind of what processes have been kind of driving the climate of the globe, you know, all of the natural processes. So you've got these kind of massive models that deal with the climate system itself. But then kind of like, you know, sort of over the last couple of hundred years or so, what some people are calling the Anthropocene, you've now got kind of human interference with that climate system. You've got growing production of these anthropogenic greenhouse gases that, you know, kind of are affecting the climate. So you've got these other models that the IPCC has to use, which is trying to model how human society is going to develop over the next 100 years to be able to try and figure out kind of how much greenhouse gas emissions can we expect by 2030, 2050, 2100. Mm-hmm. Those models, that's what I focus on. And God bless them, you know, kind of they've done their best to model. I mean, human thought and behaviour is incredibly complex, probably the most complex thing in this part of the galaxy, you know, kind of. And they've done their best to model it, but from many social scientists' point of view, those models are incredibly primitive. They're kind of very economically reductionist. In other words, they kind of reduce human behavior just to kind of economic models. You know, they don't take any account of, or virtually no account of, how politics works amongst humans and how that might affect the future. They don't even mention the human ideological realm, you know, kind of large numbers of humans on Earth believe in various sorts of gods and spirits, and that has a significant impact on how they're going to behave in the future, indeed whether they're even going to recognize climate change. You know, kind of some of the you know, quite a big section of the American evangelical community simply kind of refuses to believe that you know, there is climate change, because, you know, kind of they're going by scripture and kind of they've got a completely different interpretation. And this is, of course, across the world, and that's not being taken into account as well. Social relationships, the effects of social relationships on people's behavior, aren't being taken into account. And that's what I've kind of primarily been focusing in on, is from an anthropological point of view, you know, kind of, is there something we can kind of predict for the next 100 years, for example, about how people's religious ideologies will affect their behaviour? One of the papers I'm now working on is, if you look at the IPCC's projections of the effects of severe climate change, you know, kind of if we don't do anything about anthropogenic gases, and if kind of things don't work out very well, and we've got a kind of a rise of 4 degrees Fahrenheit or 4 degrees centigrade, there's going to be very severe ecological, meteorological consequences. And when you look at what those are, they match quite closely to what a large number of the world's religions associate with the end times. So the article I'm kind of putting together is kind of like, if we have severe climate change, to what degree will people around the world interpret that as being the end times, the apocalypse is about to kind of hit, as opposed to kind of recognizing it as climate change. And, you know, kind of, we might kind of say, well, that might be places like Africa and Asia and that sort of thing. But of course, you've got, 44% of the US population believes that Christ will return to earth within their own or their children's lifetime. So this is not something that's, you know, just applicable to other nations. We've got a big chunk of our population here. You know, kind of, if you're thinking that Christ is going to return in this generation or the next, that is the sign of that is the end times when the Messiah returns. And so it could be a kind of a, you know, severe climate change. The effects could be a severe kind of, or a major influence on a large section of our population. They will interpret it as Christ is about to return and kind of act in ways that might not be terribly helpful to mitigation and adaptation efforts. So, I mean, that's kind of one of the things I've been working on. With the paper that's been accepted in American Anthropologist, I kind of like took one of the major dimensions, or two of the major dimensions of uncertainty in the SRES modelling. This is the Special Report on Emission Scenarios. Mm-hmm. I took a couple of those and kind of, in one case, pointed out that kind of if the folks who put those models together in Laxalt, in the IASER Institute in Laxalt in Austria, if they'd actually taken any notice of the anthropological and archaeological literature, they would have been able to radically reduce the level of uncertainty that they were associating with projections over the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the paper also kind of pointed out other areas of research that anthropology could do to narrow down a lot of these uncertainties that the SRES were projecting. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of thing I'm working on now. Mm-hmm.
Have you had many opportunities to do research with other members of the Institute?
Not really. It's more kind of been me learning from them. I mean, Kurt Marsh, for example, has been useful kind of in putting together this American Anthropology. I'm not even sure he realizes this. I got to write it. But, you know, kind of every now and again we're at a retreat or on the field school or something, and I'm asking him something else about, you know, kind of the IPCC modelling procedures. And Kirk, God bless him, has been awfully useful, you know, because he's got a general hold on the whole modelling procedures. So, you know, kind of we've got a common ground to talk about. And he's been particularly useful in kind of alerting me to just how, you know, take one step backwards. You remember I was talking about those climate models of the science models of the climate, and, you know, kind of not knowing an awful lot about them. You know, you can kind of like look at them and think, oh yeah, they're pretty damn accurate. You know, and kind of Kirk's been really good at kind of saying they're really not worth an awful lot. Mm-hmm. There is so much we don't understand about ocean atmosphere transfers. You know, kind of even the forecasts for sea level rises. Those models apparently don't work very well at all in projecting past sea level rises. So Kirk has been kind of very useful. Otherwise, it's sort of the archaeologists I've kind of interacted with, sort of actually in kind of talking about my research. Mm. But, you know, kind of it's still been enormously helpful to have those other climate change scientists over there to be able to get on top of the stuff I want to talk about. Mm.
So what exactly is your role as a cooperating professor?
That's a good question, really. It means I belong to the Climate Change Institute. I kind of am a voting member. I kind of can go along to, and I'm supposed to go along to the climate change faculty meetings. I should either attend or contribute to the Bourne Symposium. I normally would go on the field trip, although for the last 2 or 3 years I've not been able to do that. One of the ways in which I've become much more engaged with the actual kind of teaching and to a lesser extent research side of the Institute is that myself and Kristen Sobolik, when she was here, she was a member of our department. Then she became associate dean. Now she's dean over at Wright State. We kind of were part of the team that put together that IGOT on adaptation to abrupt climate change. Mm. And Kristen and I kind of contributed a number of pages to the actual proposal that was successful. We've now got two in the department. We have two of those IGOT students in our new Anthropology and Environmental Policy PhD, Sam Belknap and Sky Heller. Mm-hmm. And I'm Sam's kind of dissertation, PhD dissertation advisor. I'm also kind of teaching the graduate level Human Dimensions of Climate Change course for the IGOT. So with that kind of IGOT, I've become much more integrated into some of the things that's going on over there. I contribute regularly to their research colloquia. The IGOT fellows mm-hmm. get together every other week. Mm-hmm. And although I can't get to all of those things, I get to quite a few of them, where we discuss research papers in climate change and adaptation to abrupt climate change. They have a retreat, two retreats a year, and I attend those. So that kind of has grown out of my cooperating professor status.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a joint appointment with the Department of Anthropology and CCI?
No, not in the sense of kind of like, all of my budget line comes through anthropology, so uh-huh. I don't get, none of my budget line comes through climate change, uh-huh. and that's why I don't get the course release. Our archaeologists can teach three courses a year, mm-hmm. and they have supposed to have a greater emphasis on research. Mm-hmm. The cultural anthropologists, including myself, teach four courses a year. We still have a heavy emphasis on research, but it's because my budget line is solely through anthropology that I teach four courses, as opposed to our archaeologists who teach three courses, because part of their teaching is bought out by the Climate Change Institute, which is a research institute.
Right. Okay. What do you think has been the Institute's greatest contribution to climate science?
I'm probably not the best qualified person to answer that question, but I would have said the pretty clearly, if we're just focusing on the since it's become climate oriented, mm-hmm. would be the ice cores and the stuff that Paul Majewski and his team, Gordon Hamilton and others, have been doing in kind of capturing those ice cores and then analyzing those ice cores. Mm-hmm. Those ice cores have, it's my understanding, have been tremendously influential, for example, in alerting us to the presence of rapid or abrupt climate change. As I understand it, kind of abrupt climate change was mooted, I think, by an archaeologist back in like 1954 or something, as being something that kind of might have happened in the past, or in the Holocene. But people didn't take it very seriously. My understanding is that once the GISP 2 ice cores, which Paul Majewski was heavily involved in, once they got those and they were getting good resolution mm-hmm. on the ice cores, and then suddenly it's kind of like, what the hell are all of these mm-hmm. temperatures kind of going up and down by 10 degrees centigrade in 2 years in the glacial periods? And my understanding is that it's at that point that people really started to take rapid climate or abrupt climate change seriously. Mm. And of course, Paul and his team had a very significant input to that. And they've kind of followed up on that. I mean, they're constantly going, coring every damn piece of ice they can find mm-hmm. from here to the back of the Bourne, that's been heavily influential, I think. There's other people in the Institute who are kind of doing the ecological side of this, paleoecology. Mm-hmm. Dan Sandweiss in our department did some quite influential work. This would have been back in the early 90s. I think it was the first time that, well, what he essentially did was, using archaeological evidence, he showed that essentially the whole El Niño effect had kind of started about 5,800 years ago. Mm-hmm. Before that, people kind of thought it had been going on for donkey's years. Mm-hmm. Dan always cautions me, kind of saying it didn't necessarily start. He's always kind of saying it might have been kind of lower frequencies with not so much of a magnitude prior to that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the El Niños, the mega El Niños that we get, you know, kind of like every 100 years, I believe they're kind of speeding up. Mm-hmm. Those have kind of... those are all kind of post 5,800 years ago. And Dan's kind of work on shells from the Peruvian coast was kind of key to kind of discovering that. So, you know, you've got these other things that have been fairly influential as well. But I think if you're kind of saying what's the Climate Change Institute kind of major kind of thrust and where has this made its bigger impact, my guess would be the Ice Core Library. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the ice coring activities. Mm-hmm.
Kind of on a side topic, it seems to me that within the scientific community, there's really no debate about the human role in climate change. But outside the scientific community, there is. And
yes.
I'm wondering if you can comment as to why that might be the case.
I can't really comment because it's an area that hasn't been researched very well. I mean, there is a lot of work being done in communication studies. You know, kind of there is the idea, and there's certainly something to it, mm-hmm. that kind of one of the problems is that scientists haven't communicated their findings clearly enough to the population. You know? Mm-hmm. And that's certainly kind of, there's an element to that, we could do a better job in kind of making everything clearer so that the population understands. But from an anthropological point of view, there's quite a lot of emphasis put on kind of like if we can just, you know, kind of get our message over more clearly, people will understand and climate change denial will go away. From a kind of an anthropological point of view, we look at that and we see far more social cultural processes that are involved than just kind of like, it's a lack of communication. There's all of these dynamics that are going on where it's not just kind of people don't understand the information, they have active reasons for opposing it. And those reasons kind of are very varied. I mean, in the psychology literature, there's some good research on kind of like, you know, kind of human ego defense mechanisms, you know, kind of, and kind of one very nice article that was done a year or two ago on kind of how the human moral system is not terribly well adapted to groping with these kind of major existential threats that kind of are gradual rather than sudden. You know, kind of if you've got suddenly tornadoes up the wazoo, our moral system is pretty good at kind of reacting to that, you know, and kind of taking action. But when it's something that's kind of invisible, you know, you can't see carbon, it's very gradual, at least at the moment, it's very gradual. The temperatures are only gradually rising. Our whole kind of apparatus for kind of interpreting that and for kind of judging it and kind of assigning morality to it as very poorly kind of adapted. Mm. And so you've got that kind of problem as well. People kind of, many, many people are kind of seeing these phenomena in moral terms, and the moral system is not very well adapted to kind of seeing it clearly. You've got other obvious things, you know, kind of like the political forces that kind of, it's in their interests to keep climate change denial going, because otherwise, you know, and we're talking about the fossil fuel industries, otherwise they kind of start losing money big time. That's a fairly obvious force that's kind of is keeping the whole climate change denial, or at very least the kind of uncertainty about whether climate change is with us, is fueling that. But then to go back to what I was talking about before, you've got these whole cosmological worldview problems as well, you know, kind of, you've got, to be able to kind of accept that climate change is occurring, you have to have a worldview, a kind of a religion that kind of allows you to believe that, first of all, that the climate can actually change. If you believe that the climate is governed by God and kind of God preordained it, you know, thousands of years ago, you aren't going to believe that the climate is changing, you know, kind of. And even if you do accept that, you're going to be kind of thinking, well, it's God's will whether kind of whether we're going to mitigate this or not. You know, kind of God can tweak the dials and kind of make it better again. And what we need to do is kind of like pray to him to get him to tweak the dials to make it better again. We've got all of these confounding forces. And then one thing that kind of, when I was teaching the Human Dimensions of Climate Change course last spring, that I think is way under examined in the literature is the role of the media, you know. And it's not just that the media are doing a poor job in communicating, but they have many kind of media outlets have an active interest in propagating the idea that climate change is a hoax. There's a wonderful kind of a book was written by a British doctor, Ben Goldacre, called Bad Science. And he has two chapters where he deals with the MMR fiasco in Britain. I don't know whether you're familiar with this. This is the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, which I think starting about 20 years ago, there was a doctor called Andrew Wakefield who published a very small sample study that seemed to suggest that that MMR vaccine caused autism in a number of kids. And the science was poor, very poor. In fact, Wakefield has now been struck off the medical registers in Britain because he was faked some of the data, or kind of like he acted very unethically with the data. Mm. A lot of scientific research showed that there was absolutely no risk at all. And yet they couldn't get that out because several of the tabloid newspapers, the Daily Mail, for example, a couple of the Murdoch outlets, kept kind of propagating the idea that it was a major threat. You know, you've got a whole coterie of mums kind of understandably very worried about their kids, you know, kind of, and they're kind of like, we're not going to have our kids vaccinated, and, you know, kind of, we're going to form these groups, kind of, because it's the pharmaceutical companies and the doctors, you know, kind of, who are kind of perpetrating a fraud here. And exactly the same kind of thing is going on with climate change denial. And actually, one of the newspapers that's involved in Britain is the Daily Mail. Over here, of course, it's Fox News, where they can get eyeballs on the screen or on the page by kind of fostering the idea that it's a hoax, you know, and kind of like, we don't have to worry about it. And these journalists, they know what they're doing. They know they're faking this, you know, that you know, climate change is real. But the bigger priority for them is to get the eyeballs on the screen or the eyeballs on the page. Mm. And there is this whole dynamic within the media where a whole bunch of journalists have interests in simply kind of propagating the idea, rather like the MMR vaccine, that the thing's a hoax, you know, because that's how you make your career as a journalist. Mm. And that hasn't been given that process hasn't been given the emphasis it deserves, I think. Incidentally, just with the MMR, I was just reading an article yesterday, which is compiling statistics on measles and mumps, and Britain's got extremely high levels of measles and mumps outbreaks now because of the decline in the use of the MMR vaccine. So that's a rather long answer, I'm afraid, to your rather short question about what do I think.
Oh, it was a good answer.
There's just a lot of processes involved and we don't understand them, even within the United States. And from an anthropological point of view, you're also kind of like, we also need to look at this in India, in China, you know, kind of South America, how it's kind of playing out, all of these processes there. Europe, for example, is actually doing, I think, an extraordinary, it's not my European bias, but they are doing an extraordinary good job of actually trying to mitigate climate change, you know, kind of. Germany is now carpeted with Windanlagers, you know, the windmills, kind of to try and, you know, as an alternative source of energy. But the culture over there, for some reason, is kind of more conducive to accepting that climate change is real than is the culture over here in the United States.
Well, that's all the questions I have. But before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you an opportunity to maybe share something that I didn't ask you about.
It was a pretty good set of questions. I mean, about the only thing I can add, really, Adam, is that I do feel very fortunate. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have ended up at the University of Maine. You know, kind of, I feel very fortunate that in some ways I'm kind of paid to do my hobby, you know, kind of research. I love doing research. To actually get paid for it, it's kind of like, I mean, this is all very fortunate. But particularly kind of given my background, which where I do have some hard science background and I've got a social science background, given the existential threat that climate change does pose to us, I do feel very fortunate that I kind of just happened into a kind of a university and a kind of a slot where I actually could combine these things to be able to work on climate change, you know, something that, you know, I really do feel is a major threat to humanity. And humanity is, I think, just sleepwalking towards disaster at the moment. We're simply not mitigating. Which is
sure.
No, I'll leave that one. I'll leave that. Don't worry. So you know, kind of like I feel very fortunate to have been able to just have that kind of structure situation where I could plug into things that really interest me. I mean, I still have an awful lot of anthropological interests. You know, kind of like I'm very interested in the anthropology of war. I'm trying to finish a book on war in New Guinea and, you know, the effects of war on the social structure and social organisation of places in New Guinea. But I found it very useful to have this kind of aspect of my research, which is on a subject that I think is extremely important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of the Climate Change Institute has been a very, you know, it's a good set of colleagues. We don't all see the world the same way, you know, and that, but it's a good set of colleagues, and you know, I profited greatly from it. That's about the main thing I'd add to your questions, Adam.
Okay, well, thank you once again for participating
pleasure.
In this interview.
Yeah, okay. Best of luck having to transcribe that lot.